nation. Dr. Biden, our first lady, has a PhD in early childhood education. She, of all people, should know what it takes to provide a child's safety. So the U.S. can do better. We also want to, obviously, immediate support for the reunification of those children with family members or trusted community members within the U.S. We also want engagement from Central American leaders and migrant leaders on what should be the community-based strategies to welcome these communities. These children are going to need mental health. They're going to need legal representation. They're going to need case managers to help them navigate the systems of enrolling in school, of accessing housing, healthcare, and all these basic human rights. So we have models. We have community-based models. Recently with COVID, we're building as we go. That's what we're good at. And so we need to be engaged in the conversation around what are the principles, what are the values with which this nation is going to protect and welcome children, not only values, but international obligations to protect the well-being of the child. There's also another element to this, which is our countries of origin and our governments and our countries of origin. They also have a responsibility for their nationals, and they also have the responsibility to be negotiating with the U.S. around the best interests of their children and their nationals, children or not. So I think both sides have responsibilities here. And then, of course, we, the community organizations and the community itself, our job is to raise our voices and to express our indignification.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO has a number of special t-shirts we have created just for you during our month of special programming. Whether you are a metalhead, a punk rocker, a bluegrass fan, or a feminist, we have a t-shirt for you. Wear it proudly in support of KBOO Community Radio. Go to kboo.fm/t-shirts to see all the designs. All proceeds go to support the work of KBOO Community Radio.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. Mystery writer Margaret Maron died of a stroke on February 23, 2021, at the age of 82. At the time of her death, she'd written 20 Judge Deborah Knott mysteries, 9 Sigrid Harald mysteries, 2 other novels, and 2 collections of short stories. She won an Edgar Award for Best Novel in 1993, and for Best Short Story in 2002, and was named a Grand Master by the Mystery Writers of America in 2013. Along with writing about complex women characters, her books were focused on her native North Carolina, its life and its politics. This interview for KPFA's Probabilities program was recorded on June 6, 1994, when she was on tour for her third Deborah Knott novel, Shooting at Loons. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff.
The latest book, Shooting at Loons, is very, very geographical, I think, in its orientation. As I was reading it, I had the oddest sense of deja vu, and my wife says, why you got that weird look on your face? Did you sit down crooked again? I said, no, I'm trying to think of what author she reminds me of, and then it came back to me. Marjorie Kennan Rawlings.
I remember The Yearling, of course, very clearly, and as a child I did read the book. Yes, indeed. People have also compared me to Carson McCullers. They say that Deborah is Scout all grown up, and I got that comment so much that I had never read her, but I did go back and reread her, and I must say Scout's voice does remind me of Deborah, or rather I remind me of Scout.
Well, how do you feel about this notion of regional writing, attempting for a sense of place, a sense of the way the language is spoken in a different region?
I'm all for it. I think as television and the great mobility of the 90s homogenizes out the country, it's really nice to have these regional differences. I don't think they'll ever completely disappear, no matter whether everybody plays fruit basket and everybody goes and lives in everybody else's home areas. I think climate, climactic conditions, they're always going to influence how a people responds to life. You're never going to get away from the humidity. You cannot air condition the whole South totally. There's always going to be dog flies and mosquitoes and copperhead snakes and all of the regional flora and fauna that I think will continue to influence regions.
So you think that, that there's something there that is stronger than cultural homogenization?
Mm-hmm. Every time we start thinking that that we run the world, Mother Nature turns around and slaps us down. I mean, you guys certainly know that with all the earthquakes and the fires and the droughts. You don't get too far from it.
We've had a number of guests in our probability studio over the past few months, and more over the past few years, of course, who emphasize this regionalism. We had Dana Stabenow, who is an Alaska writer, mm-hmm. Sandra West Powell from Montana.
I don't know that it's so much that we're emphasizing regionalism is that we're writing truthfully and not artificially. We are writing out of our own experiences. When I first started writing mysteries, I thought they had to be set either in New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles, that this was the only thing that interested the rest of the country. Mysteries are an artificial form, and therefore you start with this artificiality of the murder and usually an amateur sleuth, and we know it doesn't really happen that way, but then everything else around it has to be real. And so those of us who have decided to write about our home areas, I think we're trying to be honest about it. And in a mystery, it's the things that are wrong that are the red herrings and that stand out. So therefore, we try to be as accurate as possible in our settings so that when we drop the clues in, this gives our reader a chance to say, oh, no, that's not right. That must be significant. And because we are trying to write truthfully of where we are, it comes out regional, because we are all over.
A number of mystery writers say that the mystery is something, a plot to tack on to what they really want to say. It sounds to me as if you're really going for the mystery.
Mm-hmm. Of course I am. There have been essays written on why so many women write mysteries. They're kind enough to say why so many intelligent women write mysteries, and I appreciate that. And one of the suggestions is that certain women are not willing to strip their souls bare in public. And therefore, if you start with an artificial form, which the classic traditional fair play mystery is, we all write about ourselves and our experiences. But somehow it doesn't feel as soul-bearing when we clothe it in a mystery.
You have two detectives, Sigrid Harald, who's repressed, and Deborah Knott, who is far from repressed. Which one is Margaret Maron?
I think they're both me, and they're both not me. I take aspects of my own personality. It makes it easier to do the writing. I was an extremely shy, awkward person when I was growing up. I had a deep sense of inferiority and a deep self-consciousness. I thought the whole world was looking at me and pointing fingers because I wasn't doing it right. And I remembered these feelings when I created Sigrid. She is the daughter of a very beautiful Southern belle, and she grew up feeling inferior to her mother's beauty, to her father's gregariousness. She was neither of those things. Later, as I grew older, and I think once you pass 40, you quit worrying about whether or not the world notices you or is paying any attention to you. And I have, I think, probably become more confident, and Deborah reflects that. But Deborah is also a combination of my friends that I have down home, my friends' daughters, and You use everything. You take little snippets from hither, thither, and yon.
Deborah Knott is a judge.
Yes.
Have you spent many, many hours in the courtrooms of North Carolina?
Absolutely, and it is so fascinating. District court is the workhorse of the judicial system in North Carolina. I deliberately made her a district court judge because this is where all the action, interesting action, is, and it moves pretty fast. You don't have a court recorder. You don't have a jury. The judge can only adjudicate matters in the civil side up to $10,000, and in the criminal side up to 2 years in jail time. And yes, I sat there in the courtroom for hours and hours. I also discovered that I was not going to become a lawyer. I was not going to go to law school. But I had been a secretary, and I know who runs offices. So I went to the community college and took a couple of paralegal courses, and that gave me the jargon and gave me a little of the expertise of how to go and serve a writ and how to do a deposition and have those terms to throw around.
The first 100 pages of your previous novel, Southern Discomfort, virtually completely take place in the courtroom. Were those real cases?
Some of them were real, some of them were made up, some were some that were told to me. I have a network of law official friends now, SBI agents, attorneys, judges, and they tell wonderful war stories. And some of them I just can't resist. And so, yes, some of those were real, and some of them are an amalgam of several different incidents.
Dick Lupoff.
First of all, tell us what the SBI is.
Oh, I'm sorry, State Bureau of Investigation. Most states do have a Bureau of Investigation in which they do the lab work for the whole state. And I know in Georgia they just call it the GBI. They will do the paint chip analysis and all the chemical things, the testing of drugs to see whether or not they are actually drugs. They do fingerprint analysis, voice print analysis, the laser investigations. And
all the forensics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You mentioned, if I get you to back up a little bit, that in North Carolina, these district courts where there is just a judge.
Mm-hmm. And a clerk.
And a clerk, yes. But as far as the judicial, there's no jury.
And there is no court recorder. All you have is a judge sitting there reading the court papers and a clerk noting down what the judgment was. Now, this, as I say, is for the petty crimes and the petty civil dispute. If a defendant is adjudged guilty, and he does not approve, I mean, is not willing to go ahead and have the fine or accept the time, he can appeal. And then it goes to the superior. It's an automatic appeal if he wants it to appeal. And then he goes to the superior court, which is the next level up. And here is where you get your recorder, your jury, the whole thing.
Well, let's get back to Deborah Knott, who is I found a fascinating person. How did she come to be a district court judge?
Well, I made her a judge because I wanted somebody who was of the law community so that she would, if she got into a murder investigation, she functions as an amateur sleuth. And if she comes across murder, I wanted her to have access to deputies and sheriffs and be somebody who could go in and ask questions. But I made her a district court judge so that she would not ever be professionally involved in a capital case. So that if she does meddle in murder, which she certainly does, being the type of personality she is, it would not affect the judgment of the case, the trying of the case. It would not have any problem there. I also made her a judge to begin with because I wanted to send her across North Carolina. Now, you all have a very big state here in California, but we have a very wide state. It's more than 500 miles wide, and it goes from the seashore to the mountains with all the gradations in between, from the sand hills, foothills, Piedmont. And there's a whole lot happening in our state. It really is changing from an agrarian state to a more technologically oriented. We used to be tobacco, soybeans, sweet potatoes, textiles. Now we're more and more phasing out those crops and going more into the high tech, the biological, the chemical. And there's a whole lot going on that I'm not even aware of. And I thought, well, I will give myself a course on North Carolina at the end of the 20th century. District court judges and even the Superior Court judges sit in for each other at different times as they're sick or if they want a vacation. A mountain judge might ask a seashore judge to switch for 2 weeks. And one gets a mountain vacation and one gets 2 weeks at the beach.
Shooting at loons takes place in the coastal area, in fact, largely on islands.
Well, off of, across from Shackelford Banks, across from the Outer Banks. Harker's Island, which is where the book actually takes place, is right there at Beaufort and Moorhead City on the Intracoastal Waterway.
There's a conflict in this book, which strikes me as really more interesting than who killed Uncle Waldo, which is the standard. Mm-hmm. Every murder mystery is about who killed Uncle Waldo or right. some variation on the theme. But what we have in Shooting at Loons is a society in transition. You have some people that you portray in great detail, a very, very traditional lifestyle, not changed in at least 100 years, maybe several hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the fisher folk.
Yeah, the indigenous watermen, yeah.
They almost speak a different kind of English, don't they?
They do. They have the hoi-toi accent. All the I's become an O-I sound. And some people say that this is almost either a Cockney or a West England, Elizabethan English. Others say that, well, yeah, it started off with the West England accent, but it's also because these people have lived in isolation. Harker's Island was not connected to the mainland until the 40s, when a causeway was built across there. And the only way people got their mail was by the mail boat, and the fish boats used to come around and pick up the catch and take them back to the big packing houses over on Beaufort and Moorhead. And these people have lived there in isolation for 250 years.
But what about television and radio, I mean, over the last 50?
Well, certainly there was radio, but I think television was probably didn't, well, it got there about the same time it got to the rest of the state, sometime in the late 50s. Mm-hmm.
Was there a lot of interbreeding there?
Well, I don't think they would call it that, but certainly the families have intermarried for years and years. I mean, people don't marry their first cousin, clearly, but I forget how many families were actually on. And, of course, the boats, you know, brought a lot of people. But I'm saying the easy access to the island was not available until the mid-40s when they built the causeway.
You're listening to a June 1994 interview with the late mystery writer Margaret Maron, who died on February 23rd, 2021 at the age of 82. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
What about the racial structure of the island? Was
it's
it all white?
White Anglo-Saxon. No blacks at all live on the island that I'm aware of, which may or may not be a problem. But as I said, the watermen have lived there for all these years, and now the rest of the state for the last few years have been discovering what a wonderful paradise, fisherman's paradise, and everything that it is. And that's what I wanted to show. I wanted to show all these different elements that are pulling at a dwindling resource as the rivers have become more polluted and dumping more pollutants into the estuaries, which is where they are. The estuaries are the nurseries for marine life. This is where the oysters spawn. This is where the crabs begin. A lot of the fish begin there. Some of the towns are dumping in fresh water. I mean, they really are trying to be good about treating their sewage before they dump it into the rivers. But too much fresh water is also no good for estuarine life. So as these resources dwindle, and I may have my figures exactly wrong, I don't have the figures with me, but I think that it was around the turn of the century, they harvested something like 600 million pounds of oysters Last year, the catch was 300,000 pounds of oysters. I mean, down that much in less than 100 years. And as the resources become fewer, and as you have the sportsmen, what the islanders call dingbatters and dit-dots that come down for the weekend, you have the sportsmen who resent paying $300 or $400 to come down for a weekend of fishing, and there not be the fish that they used to pull out by the handfuls. You have the developers who think that there ought to be a finger canal through the marshland right up to everybody's boat dock. You have the whole tourist industry, which is based on playing in the water, jet skiing across set nets, where the islanders are trying to put their set nets out to catch fish. It's been a real problem. And so little by little, the indigenous watermen are being driven off the water, and you can feel sorry for those. And I suppose I probably come down more on their side than any other group. But nobody has all the answers. Even the islanders have not been good stewards of the water. They've dumped their old cars in it. They've used it as a bathroom and a dump and a kitchen and as a source of their livelihood. But they haven't necessarily been wonderful stewards right down the line. Nobody has all the answers. Nobody is totally white. Nobody's totally black in the whole situation. It's just a real problem.
Well, what you're talking about, the idea of basing an entire book on a controversy like this, mm-hmm. means that in a sense, you aren't just looking at the mystery. You are looking at the social problems in North Carolina.
But I don't want to be on a soapbox about it. I would like to make the people in our state aware of the fact that decisions are being made about our coastal waters that are going to affect us on into the next century. But you don't do this on a soapbox. You do it with entertainment. If they can pick up on it, that's what I'm hoping for.
Did you deal with the social issues of New York at all in your earlier novels?
No, they were pretty much the strict artificial aspect of the murder mystery. I had the characters, and I had a setting, and they were the traditional puzzle problems.
So in a sense, the Tepernot mysteries are a quantum leap for you.
I suppose you could say that, yeah. Because I was not a native New Yorker, and I used New York as a backdrop. Some people say that the city is almost another character in the books. But I suppose that I didn't feel it as deeply as I do about my native state.
Do you live at all? Do you have a house on those islands?
No, but on the cover, there's a little yellow cottage pictured. This little yellow cottage was taken from an actual photograph that I sent the artist. And we have been going down to that same little yellow cottage for 30 years, and it belongs to a distant cousin. She's something like my fourth cousin, twice removed. And we've been going there for years and years and years, and I thought it would be rather neat to make them Deborah's cousins, too.
In Shooting at Loons, Deborah is more or less on her own, except for an old boyfriend from New York who comes down. Mm-hmm. However, Southern Discomfort, Deborah has an enormous, enormous extended family.
Yeah.
Do you?
People keep asking me, they want me to do a family tree for the books. They think I ought to do a genealogical table. And I keep saying, well, once I find out how many brothers she has, I'll be happy to do one. But I don't even know. Deborah is the youngest child and only daughter of an elderly father. She is the child of his second marriage, and she has at least 11 or 12 older brothers. Twins run in the family, so they're two sets of twins. I'm not even sure. She has nieces and nephews that are older than she is. Her father, in the first book, it was called Bootlegger's Daughter, because her father was a bootlegger. He says he's not doing it anymore. Deborah believes him. I'm not sure if I do. He also says he's never killed anybody, and Deborah believes that. Again, I'm not sure myself. And that's going to be part of the fun of writing the series, to find out what all these family members are up to. Some of her brothers are pillars of the community, go to church every Sunday, vote the straight Democratic ticket, the whole nine yards. Other brothers are a bit on the wild side. They've seen the inside of jails and not on sociological tours either.
Are you yourself from a large family?
No. I used to date a guy who was from, he was about eight down in a 13-child family, and I found that endlessly fascinating, how those siblings interacted. I do have cousins. I have an awful lot of first cousins once removed, and not that many direct first cousins. But the family reunions are things that I grew up with, where you'd be in the middle of 100 people, and they were all kinfolk.
You refer to the mystery novel as an artificial form, especially mm-hmm. your earlier Sigrid Harald novels. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that in the Deborah Knott books, you're moving in a different direction, away from that artificial form into something?
Not totally away from it. When I say they're artificial, what I mean is there is a form, and you do have to follow that form, especially the kind of form that I use. In a traditional mystery, you have a crime. You have someone who must solve that crime to leave the reader with the sense that justice has been done. Now, this does not mean that good is automatically rewarded or that evil is automatically punished, but you do have to leave the reader with the sense that justice happened.
And yet, in these books, especially in the Deborah Knott mysteries, mm-hmm. You do mix in a great many contemporary social issues. I wonder then, as you get response from critics and even more to the point from just ordinary man or woman in the street readers, do they say, hey, you're preaching, cut it out and just
no,
write
because
a mystery?
I think I put it several levels down.
You do.
I usually get that they think it's funny, that my writing is funny, and they think Deborah's a hoot. They love her sassy attitude and her cockiness is the only word for it. I mean, Deborah's a mouthy person who's very comfortable in her skin. She was probably spoiled as a child in the sense that she was doted on, being the only daughter in this large family of boys. But at the same time, she also had everybody looking over her shoulder all the time and criticizing her and critiquing everything that she did. They're funny, I think, as well as being sociology.
So this makes Deborah a complex personality.
I would hope so, yeah. The thing is, Deborah really does want to be a good judge. The whole reason she became a judge, why she applied to run for judge, or filed to run for judge, I suppose I should say, is that when she was sitting in the courtroom, one of the judges in a case that was being heard ahead of her case, the judge came down really hard on a black plumber who had blown a little bit over a 10 on the breathalyzer on a dark, rainy night when there was not many people on the highway. Nevertheless, the patrolman pulled him over and charged him with drunk driving. A white person might have been allowed to get off with a warning because it was such a close thing anyhow. This judge came down so hard on the black plumber, and Deborah's attitude was that a judge should be more lenient than that, that the whole purpose of punishment is to teach a lesson, not to crush someone's spirit. Her attitude is that if the mayor's son gets to do community service for a hit and run, then the mayor's cook's son ought to be able to do community service and not see the inside of a jail. Deborah really wants to do good, but she has these two voices in her head. She's got the pragmatist on one side and the preacher on the other. She grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. You never get over that hellfire and damnation preaching that you get as a child. So she has the voice of the preacher saying, you must do good. But she also has the pragmatic voice saying, well, okay, let's do good if we can also help ourselves at the same time.
Have you heard from any judges who've read these books?
Yes.
What do they have to say?
They love it. Every judge that has written to me really, really likes them.
And what do they say specifically?
I'm right on top of it. And yes, this is the sort of thing that goes on in district courts all the time. The only cavil that I had from one judge down, or a lawyer rather, law professor down in Austin, Texas, who was worried about Deborah's love life. She just didn't seem to have as strong one as he thought she needed. And so in Shooting at Loons, we take care of that.
Margaret Maron, what is Deborah not doing now?
At the moment, she's resting on her laurels because I'm working on a new Sigrid Harrell book at the moment. Right now, Deborah is having a well-earned vacation.
Margaret Maron's next book was, as she said, in the Sigrid Harrell series, and Fugitive Colors was published in 1995. She wasn't to write another book in the series until 2017, Take Out, which was the last book she published. After Shooting at Loons, Margaret Maron would go on to write 17 more Deborah Knott mysteries. Despite the success of her novels, to date, none of her books or stories have been made into film or television series, according to IMDb. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves. Book Waves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
Like the KBOO Community Radio Facebook page. Find KBOO Community Radio on Facebook and like our page, and have events, ticket giveaways, and great information delivered directly to your personal feed. One out of every seven humans is on Facebook, so using Facebook to